Hey folks, this is Simon Ward. Welcome to the High Performance Human Podcast. It's time for another episode where we are devoted to helping you achieve optimal human performance. Please check out my website, simonwardtriathloncoach.com, for all my latest blogs and send your questions to beth@thetriathloncoach.com. If you're not already a subscriber to the show, please go to simonward.podbean.com, where you can subscribe and make sure you don't miss any of our weekly episodes. Hey everybody, welcome back. If you can remember last week's show where Stephen Seiler and I were talking, we had a fantastic conversation all about polarized training. So hopefully we've set the groundwork for you. And today we want to continue that discussion as Stephen answers your questions about polarized training. So let's crack on. Okay, everybody, well, welcome back. This is part two of my conversation with Stephen Seiler. And today, or in this part, we are going to answer the listeners' questions. So thank you to everybody who sent them in. So I'm going to try and make this a quicker question-answer session, Stephen, rather than the long conversation we've just had. So for those people who haven't perhaps heard your outline of polarized training or are new to this subject, can you just, is it possible to summarize a dumbed-down recap of what exactly polarized training is, please?
Well, the dumbed-down recap is basically for every 8 days of training you do, about 7 or 8 of them should be at an intensity that is very tolerable, that you could actually talk to the person beside you, and that when you come in the door after the training session, you don't feel like you are about to, you know, need to go throw up in the toilet. You do have an appetite pretty quickly, and you can get on with life. You don't feel like you've shattered yourself. So 8 out of those 10 days are quite tolerable, quite doable, and even enjoyable, dare I say. And then a couple of those days out of every 10, you say, yep, today I'm going to push on the pedal. I'm going to do intervals, or I'm going to do a really hard steady state, or I'm going to do a race, or and so forth. So that's the basic distribution, is, you know, 7, 8 out of 10, green, tolerable, easy, enjoyable, no appetite suppression when you come in the door. And then a couple of them are those typical really pedal to the metal sessions.
Yeah. I love the traffic light analogy, really, you know, the green and the red. Stay out of the orange zone as much as possible. I mean, you mentioned in our previous conversation about the breakdown of your daughter's training, that 3% roughly, I think it was, would have been in the orange zone. And I did want to ask you then whether that was planned or whether it was accidental, like she was doing a run on a hilly course and she just ended up drifting into that zone because of the terrain.
It's mostly drifting. It's mostly a little bit, you know, that really hard sessions, there is some middle intensity just because they're going in and out of the, you know, the high intensity. But there have been a few very specific workouts, like prepping for a half marathon, where the race pace is right up, you know, is in that threshold range, where she did intentional threshold sessions. But they are quite rare, actually, for her.
Yeah, and I think that's the important thing. And again, I reference Dan Plews here because he unashamedly says a lot of what he does is based around your hierarchy of endurance needs. So he references you very, very well in there and frequently. Is that there is a time and a place for what's often known as sweet spot. It's this sort of threshold training in between those two turn points we've talked about. But generally, that is in a race-specific phase, and it has to be specific to the event you're doing, and it's probably for just 6 to 8 weeks, if that, but not all year round.
Absolutely. So there's nothing poisonous about threshold training. It's just that there's no such thing as, let's call it, poisonous workouts, but there can be poisonous distributions. Meaning if you do it every day, then it starts to become problematic for the body. And so that's where the threshold issues become problematic. And the other thing is to understand that if you do a tough threshold session, it's in the 20%. It is hard. It, you know, it, it, it may not feel hard the first 30 minutes, but when you're at threshold for 75, 90 minutes, it takes a toll on the body. And so you have to see it as one of those hard sessions.
Hmm. Okay, we've talked about, we've recapped on what polarized training is. What if you could outline your top five benefits of somebody following a polarized training, what would they be?
Well, I didn't always think about this so much at first, but one of the big things that I've been so pleased to hear feedback-wise is people say, you know what? I enjoy training again.
Yeah.
So that would be number one, is that people realize they can actually go out the door and do a 90-minute run, come back and not feel shattered, and that's okay. And they feel good and they feel healthy. So that's, I guess, number one, is that you develop this kind of sustainable pattern where every day is not a psychological warfare with getting yourself out the door knowing you're going to suffer. And then you have more energy to do those tougher sessions. Another issue is that you do use the full range of the adaptive signals that the body kind of through evolution is designed to create. In duration is part of your toolbox, but we tend to be intensity focused. And so we kind of only focus on that part of the toolbox instead of extending. So I often talk about every time you do a workout, you're making a decision. Am I intensifying today or am I extending? And extending turns out to be a good choice a lot of the time. So that's another issue, is just using the full adaptive signal toolbox. Another issue is you improve your durability. When you use this polarized approach, you get in those long, easy runs or rides, you become more durable. And we see, you know, one of the things you'll see with elite performers is just how unaffected they are by, you know, when they cross the finish line. They're so darn durable, but that's because over time they built that up. It's not something that happened overnight, but they tolerate these hard sessions because they've done a lot of easy sessions also. They've got good durability, and that can be improved quite a bit by getting the in distribution right. Another is that we basically, it all relates, but we reduce the stress relative to the signal. And that's part of that sustainability issue, is every training session creates some adaptive signal, but it also carries with it stress. And if we can tweak the composition of the sessions and the training so that we get more signal for less stress, then that's good. Doesn't mean you're soft. It means you're smart and you're getting the most out of your training and fitting it into your life better. And then I guess finally, I would say that by getting this distribution right, you improve the quality of those hard sessions that you want to do. Oftentimes the quality of those sessions is chronically impaired by the fact that we just never fully recover. We don't go into those sessions ready to fully mobilize because we kind of got the brakes on. The sympathetic brakes are often on because of the chronic, you know, too much hard training.
The next question,
that was five.
Yeah, I suspect there are more, but those five, if you can tick all of those boxes, you'll get a long way towards your goals, I think.
That's right.
I had the next question down as what the common mistakes an athlete can make when switching to polarized. And I guess those would just be the polar opposites of what you've just mentioned. It strikes me that the biggest one is this, I term that enjoyability zone, the green zone, as the guilty zone, because when you come back in the door and you don't feel smashed, you feel guilty that you didn't go any harder. And I call the red zone the feeling sick zone, because that's generally what you feel like when you've done those sessions properly. But and people don't like doing that, so they back off, and so they end up in that sort of, you know, not in red and not in green.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, you avoid guilt and you avoid sickness, and you end up in this kind of middle area that where you do get a nice endorphin kick. But the problem is that it gets. You stagnate there, because one of the best ways to create an overtraining or overreaching response for the body is a monotone, relatively high stress. That's true in the workplace. It's true in the training field. And unfortunately, that tends to be the default that a lot of people fall into, where they land, like you say, in that yellow or orange zone. They get out the door, they feel time stress, so they can't, they don't have time for a 90-minute run, so they make it a 45-minute run, which means they have to go, you know, they feel like they should go pretty hard, so they're right at their threshold for 45 minutes. And then when they're going to do an interval session tomorrow, well, they're not quite recovered, and so that session's not going to be very good, really. So this is that pattern that tends to happen. And when people try to switch over to this, obviously they've got a lot of inertia going mentally. And so it's hard to let themselves actually stay green, stay in that zone. It's hard to come to the bottom of a hill and find out, you know what, if I'm going to actually stay in the green zone, I'm going to have to actually walk up this darn hill because it's too steep for me to run up. And that's tough on a male ego, particularly. The females tend to handle that better, but us males, you know, we cannot abide by someone passing us up a hill or on the bike. And so what do? We start half wheeling, and before we know it, that green zone ride has turned orange just because of our stupid egos. And we forgot what the intention was. We forgot the goal. So those are the risk issues. And when people get past that and they get better at, you know, letting the people drive, fly by them on the bike on those days when they know what they want to do, then they also get better at being able to go fast when they want to go fast, you know, on those red zone days. So that's what we see with elite performers. And that's what we see with good age groupers that figure this out.
So pretty much looping back to this phrase, intensity discipline there then. But you know, it seems to me like the common mistake then is actually taking your ego out on a ride or a run with you. You need to leave it at home sometimes.
Yeah, plan your work. And if your plan today is 90 minutes, low intensity, you know, talking pace run, then gosh darn it, stick to your plan. Show me you can do that. And if you do that, then things are going to start getting better.
This whole thing about sweet spot training, which is in the orange zone, you know, if I've interpreted the diagrams correctly, is sort of, it becomes confusing, doesn't it? Because it would in a lot of people's minds, sweet spot would indicate that's the place where you want to spend your time. But what we're really saying from this is it's kind of hard and kind of easy, but neither of those. And as you said, if you do too much time in that sweet spot, you stagnate.
Yeah, and I think it's a good, in some ways, it's a good term, because sweet spot, we gravitate towards it. You know, we gravitate towards the chocolate in the refrigerator, and we gravitate towards the sweet spot because it feels like an acceptable balance between duration and intensity. And anything that we do just repetitively, we tend to stagnate at. It ceases to be adaptive. And eventually it becomes maladaptive. It becomes, you know, it becomes kind of a chronic thing. I've even had people say, you know what, I think my maximum heart rate has increased 10 beats. And I say, how can that be? And they say, well, because I finally figured out that I was chronically tired. I was working out all the time at threshold. And when I started distributing my training differently, I recovered, and now my maximum heart rate's 10 beats higher, you know? And so you see these things that happen, the body does tend to stagnate with repetitive loading in what initially feels like a good intensity. I get it. I mean, it's very tempting for me to go up into that threshold intensity, because I can go there and I can feel good there for quite a while. But I also know that it really fatigues me if I do it daily. You know, I don't get better.
I was on my Sunday ride yesterday with my friends. Now, we actually are pretty good. We keep a fairly low average heart rate, and we chat around our rides, and I think we're probably out for 4 or 5 hours most weekends. But we constantly get passed by other groups, mostly of men, riding. And you can see that they're riding harder. You can see when they go up hills that they're pushing big gears and they're all working hard to keep up. And I do wonder, when they're out on that Sunday ride, if that's the egos, that's sort of five or six males together. You know, they haven't seen each other all week. They're all eager to show who's fittest and who's been responding to training. And I have another rule that I say, you either go in training anyway, you either go hard or you go long, but don't do them both together.
Yeah. Oh man. At least with my physiology, that combination, the other day I did a Zwift ride that was scheduled to be 200 kilometers. And that's a long ride on Zwift. You know, it's a long ride anywhere, but it's a long ride on Zwift. And to make things more interesting, they put it on the, if you're familiar with the platform, they put it on the Crit City course.
Right.
Which is a 2 kilometer loop, basically. So 102 laps of the Crit City course, which is basically flat, but it turns out not exactly flat because every darn loop, the lead group was surging at 400, 450 watts up the little incline. Well, when you do that for 3 hours, it is not an endurance. It was absolutely devastating. For
3 hours, 70K an hour you were riding up.
My intention was to do 200K, but pretty quickly I realized, because we were surging, you know, if I was going to stay with this lead group, you know, 130 people just started whittling down very quickly. So by the time I got to 3 hours, only 20 people were left, and I was one of them. And then I said, I can't go. I'm done. I'm cooked. You know, and only 12 people finished the 200K ride that started with 130. But that's the ego going on, you know? And so when I looked at my ride file, it was just every 2.5 minutes, it was a big surge. So 70 of these big surges, I was shattered, you know, and that's that Sunday ride you're describing. It, the egos, everybody was going to just show each other who's boss and see who could survive instead of it being a good 200 kilometer endurance ride. It became a war of attrition.
The next question, I think we've probably answered, but it, should I follow a polarized training approach year round or only during race specific training? My sense from everything we've discussed is that this is the way you shape your training year round, and then you manipulate close to races, close to your A races, with some specific training which might fall into the sweet spot for particular sessions.
Right. That's the way I would see it. And that's, you know, the person I do coach day to day is my daughter. And that's the way we, you know, the basic model, the basic intensity distribution is the same year round. Now, you know, other than a month where she's basically recovering. But these specific workouts, the race prep, the very pace specific rate training that's in that 20% may range from threshold sessions like that you would call sweet spot, all the way up to track sessions, hard repeats in zone 5, or you know, the highest intensity zone.
Yeah Okay. And so then the next question will be which again I think we've answered, is if most events have been cancelled for 2020 now, so should I begin training now for 2021? Now, as a coach, if somebody started following a polarized training approach now and, you know, using your hierarchy of endurance needs, focusing on just getting the frequency and volume in, particularly in the summer when you can get out for longer on the bike, it's nicer in the weather. It's a perfect time to just lay down a great platform of just building up the miles and focusing on the process, and maybe honing your technique and your efficiency. And then once the weather and the days shorten in the winter and the weather turns a bit, then that's an opportunity to maybe do a little bit more intensity. And then, and then all of a sudden we're in next year and you've built up this huge, great big, you've built up this lovely cape that you're going to ice.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I know it's really frustrating for a lot of people that had very specific goals for events they were going to do, but there are always positives, you know, behind the clouds. And for a lot of athletes who have either a chronic injury issue, or like you say, they haven't really had time to build up a good base. So this has been a golden opportunity. It still is a golden opportunity to just build durability, enjoy your training. And it's what ends up happening to people that they don't expect is that while they're doing this base building, they find out that, you know what, my intervals didn't go so badly. You know, they suddenly they do a high intensity session and they're expecting it to go terribly because they haven't done much high intensity, but they've got such a solid base that they do quite well on their interval session. So it's not like it's either or. They bleed over, they transfer over into each other. So you're building a base that you're going to be able to transfer into those tough interval sessions. And you'll get a pretty rapid response from those as well. So this is what the top performers understand, and we just got to learn from them.
This is always a question that comes up, and no doubt it comes up every time you do a presentation to athletes that are time crunched. How can I best incorporate polarized training into my week or month if I'm crunched for time? Now, I think we've talked about this. You know, I've only got limited time, so therefore I'm going to smash every single hour that I have because I can't do the volume.
Right. That's what I'm going to say, and this is where I'm going to get, I don't have pure data to do this, although there is some data. If you are so constrained that you've only got, let's say, 3 days a week or 4 days a week to train, and you know, your husband or wife says, look, that's it. You get 4 hours a week or else I'm out of here. Okay, if you're that constrained, what do I do? Well, one, the most typical solution would be if I got 4 hours and I'm going to do 4 1-hour threshold runs or rides, right? That would be the default.
Yep.
But I'm going to give you another way. I'm going to say, look, if you've got 4 hours to your disposition for that week, I'm gonna make you a hero for your partner because you're gonna say, honey or dear, I'm only gonna train 3 days a week. I know you said 4 hours and I could train 4 days a week, but I'm gonna go with three because you know what? We're gonna do a secret. On that one of those days, you're gonna go 2 hours. You're gonna go longer. And you're gonna give up a day just to achieve that. So you're gonna end up with a 1 hour interval session, a 1 hour just basic green zone session where you might do some extra strides or some sprints or some core training or whatever. And then you're going to do a 2 hour long ride or the equivalent run, a long run. So we're going to get some extension. We're going to, you know, extend one of those workouts and we're going to get a good quality interval session. And then we're going to get a bridge session that I don't want you to wear yourself out at, but it's going to just give you continuity and can keep the signal going. And so now you've got three workouts in a week. You get 4 hours of actual work time and you don't get divorced. You don't, you know, create big problems in the house because it's time crunch. And I am willing to bet you, you'll get pretty darn good results from that because you're going to increase your durability and you're going to get a quality interval session. And you'll be able to recover for both. So that would be my basic recipe if you're constrained that much because there's even a study where they compared weekend warriors that only trained on Saturday and Sunday with a group that trained the exact same total volume, but trained 5 days a week. There was no difference in their VO2 max improvement, their threshold improvement, and the race results. So it is possible. And so that's interesting because it shows that long is good too, meaning duration is part of the signal. And these people who did two long workouts on Saturday and Sunday had just as good a overall result as people who did five short training sessions in a week.
We should perhaps share the link for that research if you have it, Stephen.
Yeah, I will find it. It's not in my head, but I'll find it. Because I've shown it in some presentations.
Okay, that will be good. Well, that's great because I think, you've answered a question that's on a lot of people's lips that are time crunched. B, you've got 4 hours. You're not finishing all of those sessions feeling absolutely wiped out. Therefore, as you, a phrase you used earlier, you can get on with your life after those sessions, can't you? You're not creating that extra stress that you have to recover from. And best of all, you've maintained some sort of harmony in the household. And that's something else that we coaches of successful athletes often talk about, is having environments where they have harmony and stability contributes to better performance because you tend to relax more, you tend to sleep better because there's no tension.
Yeah, harmonious obsession is much healthier than other kinds of obsession. So,
harmonious obsession.
Yeah, there's
paradox.
The psychology people say, you know, obsessive people or, you know, people, obsession is of course an issue they look at, but harmonious obsession is a healthier version of obsession that is sustainable. That, you know, because athletes do tend to be obsessed with their goals. So we have to live with some of that obsession, but how can we make it more harmonious with all the other stuff going on in life?
Cool. Okay. Onwards quickly then. If an athlete doesn't use heart rate or other devices, so power meters, I guess, what's the best way to gauge efforts? So how do we get that distinction between Where do we turn from green to orange zones? And how do we know when we've gone out of the other side of that orange zone and into red zone?
Well, you kind of took away part of my toolbox because one of the things I would look at with heart rate is just heart rate drift. Is that if it's if you're in that green zone where you should be, your plan is to be there for 90 minutes, you basically from about 15 minutes in, once you've kind of warmed up and found your pace, your heart rate should stay pretty stable. It shouldn't just go up, up, up the whole time, as long as you're not, you know, it's not 90 degrees outside or 32 C or whatever. So that's one thing. But since you say no heart rate, then I'm going to go to the talk test. You know, you should be able to talk to the person beside you without just becoming totally winded. That's a surrogate test of what's going on with your ventilation. Are you starting to hyperventilate? And if you are, then you're in your threshold zone, or above. So the talk test has been shown to be valid. It does, help you to regulate intensity. And, you know, you say, well, I'm sitting here alone. I'm running alone or I'm cycling alone. How do I do a talk test? Well, just talk, you know, you can just test and say, can I talk out loud and not, you know, become winded, not have to stop and catch my breath. And so that's a good surrogate indicator, that you can use. Some people have even said you can close your mouth and nose breathe if you're in the green zone. But, and I've done that, but I can cycle along for 2 hours at 200 watts with my mouth closed, as long as my sinuses are open, you know. But if I've got a little bit of a sinus issue, then that ain't going to happen. So some people have done that. And then in general, just the talk test. Oh yeah. If you're running, Jack Daniels years ago in his book, Daniels Running Formula, there was a little area in the book or a little passage in the book where he talked about breathing rhythm, where you're breathing in over maybe four strides and breathing out over three strides. We come into a rhythm, and he basically he didn't have data, but he was basically alluding to the idea that these different rhythms, as you go up in intensity, you kind of get forced into a different breathing rhythm. So you can do 4-3 at low intensity, but you won't be able to do 4-3 if you're in your threshold or if you're above your threshold. It'll become maybe 3-2 or something. And so this, he didn't really test this hypothesis, as far as I know, with any systematic publications or anything, but I've actually got a master's student. We're going to do this. We're going to look at the relationship between breathing rhythm, you know, the rhythm of breathing up against the running frequency or the running cadence, and how it relates to where they are intensity wise and whether it serves as a surrogate measure.
I've noticed that myself. I've been doing a bit with yoga breathing and sort of belly breathing with my physio, and focusing on breathing and breathing patterns and trying to associate, when I've been riding my indoor trainer, associating those breathing patterns with particular power levels and particular heart rates. And I think I've got it to the point now where I can tell when my heart rate's around 135, I can sense a changing in my breathing pattern. And if I'm not looking at my watch and then I suddenly look at it, I can be within a couple of beats of knowing what my heart rate is. And I know when I get into that threshold running zone, I'm usually on a 2-2 breathing pattern. And then once we get into the VO2 max stuff, it's just all over the place and it's basically trying to get oxygen in.
Right, right. Yeah, so breathing, you know, that when even when we take people into the lab, we measure blood lactate, but we also measure ventilatory responses. So, and depending on a little bit on the protocols and stuff, but you can use what's called ventilatory thresholds as surrogates for lactate thresholds. And they match up pretty darn well, usually. And that's because once you start building up, a lot of these hydrogen ions, the lactate and so forth, your body starts getting rid of it by hyperventilating. You try to blow off the extra CO2. So that's why there is a link between ventilation and intensity. So these hacks that we're talking about, meaning just kind of tuning into your ventilation, they're legitimate. They're connected to the physiology. And then, you know, whether in rowing and running particularly, there's a word we use, a fancy physiology term or a fancy term called entrainment. It just means that these rhythms end up connecting to each other. So your breathing rhythm ends up being tied to your movement rhythm. So if you're at a certain rhythm in rowing, your breathing will be tuned in or entrained on your rowing frequency. And if you're running, it'll be entrained on your cadence. So they don't operate independent of each other. The body, they lock in. They phase change as intensity increases. Suddenly your breathing has to just jump to a new rhythm because of the intensity.
I don't know about you, but I find as well when I'm doing those some of those HIT sessions and I'm getting to the point where my mind's starting to want to, you know, tell my legs to stop. If I focus on my breathing and getting my breathing in rhythm, that can actually help me to get to the end of the rep.
Absolutely. And you know, and there's an interesting, this is just a bonus for all listeners. And it wasn't discovered by me. It was discovered by a physiologist or a guy who's done thousands and thousands of lab tests on Norwegian athletes. And he eventually did publish this. But if you are in a race and you are in a race where there is variation in the terrain, you're coming up on a hill, one of the things you should do and can do to help yourself is to use anticipatory hyperventilation, meaning you know that you're going to need more air in as you attack that hill. So you just start breathing hard before your brain normally tells you to anyway. And what that does is it cuts out the delay that normally would happen that between the biochemical signals that normally would start to build up as you start pushing the hill and the increase in ventilation. Well, you know it's going to come, so you can cut that out and help yourself by just going ahead and start breathing hard. And this works. It's used by cross-country skiers in Norway, by rowers. I've started trying to remember and do it myself. So you just do an anticipatory increase in your breathing when you come to the bottom of those steep hills, and it does help a bit.
Almost sounds like the Wim Hof method. I don't know if you're familiar with Wim Hof, but he uses this hyperventilation when he's training people to overcome altitude problems. He even claims that he can take people to altitude where they normally need to use supplementary oxygen, and using this hyperventilation breathing that he has, get them to work at those higher zones without supplementary oxygen. But we're definitely not advocating this here when we're talking about polarized training.
Well, it's kind of interesting. I'm not familiar with that, but I do know that one of the adaptations that happens when we take athletes to altitude is they just they begin to hyperventilate more. But that takes a little bit of time. And so their body adjusts by just ventilating, you know, increasing the amount of air they're moving in and out of their lungs. But the point is that you can do it in a feed forward way where you're just telling yourself, I'm going to need this. So I might as well just turn it on and avoid the delay, avoid the lag time.
So that's definitely going to work with shorter hills, isn't it? So if you're on a route, you know, cycling or running, when you've got something that's 30, 60, 90 seconds long, that would work. On a 15 or 20 minute hill, it's perhaps not going to be as much of an advantage.
It's not going to help on Alpe d'Huez, but it does help on these really stochastic sit courses where you've just got these little 10, 20, 30 second surges.
Yep.
That's where this can be very beneficial because it kind of smooths out the buffering issues that you're trying to deal with.
Yeah, because I guess what you see when you notice this, when we, for instance, we talk about those Sunday rides, you come to a short hill, everybody powers up the hill, but then everybody slows down at the top because they're out of breath and they have to get the breath back. So exactly. you can cut that out by, you know, getting the air in when you're actually riding at a relaxed pace first.
Yeah, and if you know you're going to do this surge and you're going to try to, you know, that would be my physiological strategy is I'm going to do an anticipatory hyperventilation at the bottom of the hill. I'm going to press up and then I'm going to press over the top of the hill and try to get some meters on the pack when they're catching their breath. So that's exactly what I would do if I were strong enough.
So bonus tip there from Dr. Seiler. Let's quickly whistle through this one, Stephen. The next one, I think we've probably already answered this. It's from Jeff Zellner. Jeff asks, how will 80-20 make me stronger in the latter stage of the run? So let me see if I've been a good student and listened to the professor this morning. This goes back to what we were talking about with cardiac drift. Particularly, I know this guy, he's one of my training group. He's talking about in the latter stages of an Ironman, if he has developed that durability through months and years of green zone training, in the latter half of an Ironman, he's not going to experience the cardiac drift, and therefore his body's going to be able to maintain that pace. He might drop off a little bit, but he's just going to be able to handle that fatigue and everything else that comes in the latter stage of an Ironman run.
Yeah, I mean, that in the Ironman, of course, is what the Ironman is. It's a test of durability. It's not an intensity test. It's a durability test because you're, over the course of the many hours of that race, it's not like you're encroaching on your VO2 max. You're not using the intensity range, but you're stretching yourself so far on the duration side that by the time you get to the back half of that race, all those lab tests you may have done where you measured your VO2 max, you measured your so-called FTP or whatever, well, I hate to tell you, but you don't have that FTP after 5 hours. You don't have, if you had 60 mLs per kg, fresh, I'm sorry, but that's probably not what your true VO2 max is now after 5 hours in the Ironman or six or seven. So you are in a war of attrition with yourself and you're trying to manage your body. You're trying to become more durable so that you're able to sustain that 65, that 70% of max level longer without falling apart. So it really is fundamentally a durability issue. And that's what's going to give you the dividends, not necessarily another high intensity interval session.
This brings me on to our next question then. And I know you're not a nutritionist, but it may be something that you have an understanding of. The listener, Sarah Lee, asked, does fueling need to be adapted to support polarized training? Now, I've had a few conversations with Phil Maffetone, and obviously, I've referenced Dan Plews quite a bit, who does, and both of those guys are very stronger on the low-carb, higher-fat approach. And I guess if you're with a polarized approach, we're spending a lot of time in the green zone, in what would essentially be a fat-burning zone or minimum glycogen-burning zone. And if we have a diet that favors too many carbohydrates, does that help to or encourage the body to work at a slightly higher level because it's familiar with carbohydrates? Or am I just getting things mixed up here?
Well, I'm you know, I'm not going to get into a big discussion on diet, but I will say that if you're training, I do think one of the potential limiting factors that hits us if we do a lot of threshold training every day, you're going to your threshold and you're trying to be there a long time, is carbohydrate availability. Because we do know that there is a non-linear relationship. As intensity increases, the glycogen and carbohydrate utilization rate increases in a non-linear way. And so the so-called sweet spot, which, you know, if we call that the threshold, then you're at a fairly high rate of carbohydrate utilization and also doing it for a fairly long period of time. Well, that's a prescription for glycogen depletion. And then you get into issues of recovery. And so one of the things that I think athletes, one of the reasons athletes use this polarized model where they do a lot of green zone is probably it's energy management. And that translates to, yeah, more fat burning, more, you know, 65% is typically kind of around that fat max if you look at some of the lab studies. And that seems to be an intensity where athletes do a lot of their green zone training, is at something that looks kind of suspiciously like fat max. So there may be a reason for that, or there may be an association for why that is true.
Yeah, that could be a whole nother podcast altogether, couldn't it? Talking about how this relates to our nutritional needs and demands.
And there's other people that are much better at all that than me, so I'll leave that to them to interpret.
Does the polarized approach have a different impact depending on the age of the athlete?
I would just say that it becomes more imperative that you are sensitive to the recovery side of the equation and your body's need to manage its overall stress capacity. So as we get older, you know, we do tend to need more recovery time between those hard efforts, whether they're long threshold sessions or high intensity interval sessions or races. You know, they all end up in that same high stress box. And we just have to, you know, maybe when I was 20, I only needed a couple of days to come back. Now I'm at 55, I need a good 3. I may even, you know, be okay with 4, you know. So, but I still love racing. I still love going to the, you know, carrying a shovel and going hard upon occasion. But I've got to be sensible and not do it so often that it just kind of digs a hole for me.
Okay, we've got a question. So we're talking about MAF here. Are you familiar with MAF and Maffetone and everything that he talks about?
I didn't even know the name until maybe a year and a half ago or something, but I have at least learned about 180 minus age and lots of fat burning and stuff like that.
Yeah. Maximum aerobic function, I think it is. No, I think most people think that MAF is just the first three letters of his surname, and they are, but it's a coincidence. So we have, the reader says, I am 60, so my MAF heart rate is 180 minus 60 is 120. I have a resting heart rate of 48 and a max heart rate of 180. What would be the Dr. Seiler easy heart rate zone? Now, is it, so first question, I suppose.
Well, this is like math on the radio here.
Yeah. is it possible to work out just from theoretical maximums what your easy heart rate zone is, or do we really need to do either a lab test or just do that torque test and say it, and is it really black and white anyway? Is it just a gray zone as long as it's somewhere between these sort of 5 or 6 beats? That's fine.
Well, let's start at the start. Number one, these equations in general: 220 minus age, 208 minus 0.7 times age. There's a whole bunch of them. They're based on regression lines. They're based on drawing what's called a line of best fit through a whole bunch of data points. It can be 157 from, you know, I had 157 athletes that had done the same VO2 max test, and I got their max heart rate. It can be thousands from one of these epidemiological studies. And they say something about overall population trends. And what you find is, yeah, as you get older, your max heart rate in general goes down. But at the individual level, you can see up to a 40 beat per minute difference at any given age. You could take 10 45-year-olds and their maximum heart rates can range from 165 to 205. You know, and so there's a high degree of individual variation, and that makes these equations essentially useless at the individual level. Okay. Now, having said that, and unfortunately, I'm going to just say 180 minus age falls into that same issue, same category. This time he's just chopped off 40 beats, you know, to try to move it down into a lower intensity range, but it's still going to be a victim of the same individual variation. You need to kind of know your max heart rate. It really helps. And so now your listener who asked the question, he's presented me with a couple of values. What was it? 48 resting heart rate and 182 or something max heart rate?
180.
Okay. So he's helped us here because now he knows his max heart rate. He knows his resting heart rate. And you say, well, they can vary a bit from day to day. Yeah, but he's definitely narrowed the range of error. And so now 180 minus 48 gives us 132, I believe.
Yep.
So that's his heart rate reserve. That is the number of beats he has to work with. So basically we can say that there's a nice correlation between the percentage of heart rate reserve that you're working at and the percentage of your VO2 max you're at. You've got the little issue of resting VO2, but basically there's a pretty close one-to-one relationship. If you're at 50% of your heart rate reserve, you're going to be pretty close to 50% of your VO2 max. Okay. So this, you know, for whole body activities. So now we've kind of helped ourselves and I can say, all right, sir, you want to be at about 60% of your VO2 max, then we need to just find what is about 60% of that heart rate reserve, 0.6 times 132. Okay. And that's what, about 80?
79, 80. Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll say 80 just to round off a bit. So now 80 represents the percentage of his heart rate reserve he needs to be working at to be at 60%. So we take the 80, add it back to the 48 because it's there all the time.
Yep.
So 80 plus 48 is 128. So I'm going to, as a good guess, I'm going to say, all right, about a heart rate of 128 for you is going to put you at about 60% of VO2 max. Okay. And that's going to be a educated, but it's a better estimate than just saying, take 220 minus age and then take 70% of that. It's going to be closer because we've calibrated a bit.
Okay. That's the Carvonan method you talk about, yeah?
Yeah, it's nothing. There's no rocket science here. It's been around forever. But we forget good stuff. We forget basic things sometimes. So that's one of the things. So in my own, when I look at my cardiac drift, for example, I calibrate it using heart rate reserve versus percent of 6-minute power. And because those two are almost one-to-one correlated, you know, the ratio is about one for me when I'm fresh. And then as I get fatigued, that ratio goes up.
Right. So 6-minute power is your second turn point, and 60% of VO2
No, 6-minute power is my VO2 max surrogate.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I use 6-minute power as that's the power that I think will push me up to VO2 max. It kind of represents my maximum aerobic power or whatever.
Ah, right.
It's a surrogate. And it also, so 100% of that correlates to 100% of my heart rate reserve. With me?
Yep.
So both of those scale from 0 to 100. And it works pretty good for me, you know, and that's some features I've built into this Endura analytics program we use to actually look at what's going on during these long rides or during long workouts.
Okay, right. Stephen, I'm conscious now we've nearly broken the record for the amount of time we've been conversing, but I've split it over two podcasts, so it doesn't count as breaking the record.
Well, yeah, you've done what athletes do. You're doing, we're doing a double workout.
A couple more questions for you. When you do any strength and conditioning work or flexibility work, does this count as time within the 80% bit, or do you ignore it? I think that's separate, isn't it? Is mobility, yeah, flexibility,
strength. We've kept it separate. And I'm of course, accept that it's a stress, it's particularly if it makes you sore. So that's one athletes always say, just don't make me sore. So it does add up, but it's a different kind of stress. It's more related to creating a bit of muscle damage and so forth that makes you a bit sore. And so that's what I worry about when I'm doing strength training, is just to make sure it doesn't hurt the quality of the session. So we tend to, you know, my daughter, she does some strength training on easy days.
My thoughts on strength training are, if you have sessions that are going to work on specific things and you are going to get a bit sore, that needs to be a certain time of the year when it's a priority, and therefore the sport-specific stuff that you do is perhaps less of a priority, so it doesn't matter if you get a bit sore.
Yeah, and obviously soreness, that's an adaptation thing, and so if as long as you keep doing a bit of maintenance strength training, then you're not going to get sore. So that's one of the issues, is when we stop doing the strength training and then start to pick it up again, that's when then it really disturbs the training process for a week or two.
So that's a great reason why strength training needs to be a year-round activity and not just, you know, in the off season, which is what tends to happen for a lot of athletes, you know.
Yeah, you know, because there's no point if you're going to do it for 3 weeks and then stop and do it for a month and then stop, you're just constantly dealing with these, you know, readapting, yeah, and going through that soreness phase again and again and again.
My sense is that the listeners asked, within a training block, does 80-20 ratio vary within hard versus recovery week? So I think what they're asking there is, should we have any high intensity work during the recovery weeks?
Well, it depends. Yeah, you might, if you normally have two hard sessions or even three hard sessions, then I would back it down maybe to one hard session during that recovery week. And then the hard wouldn't necessarily be too hard, but, you know, just kind of keeping the rhythm of your training going, but backing down on the number of hard sessions. So very typically it's like three up, one down, 3 weeks, kind of pretty tough load. And then a 1 week load reduction. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways to reduce the load is just to drop one of the hard sessions, not necessarily both, but it depends on how fatigued you are. And if you are fatigued and you really need to unload, then yeah, get rid of all the hard training that week. And it's not going to hurt you. It's not like you're suddenly going to lose your 10% of your VO2 max, I promise.
Yeah, and again, it depends, doesn't it? It depends on age, it depends on the other stresses in your life, it depends on a whole lots of things. So you need to be fairly adaptable and willing to be adaptable.
If I can get across any take-home message to people, is don't be afraid to have a week of training where you just basically smell the roses and do, you know, easy long rides or easy long runs. If you're in a high stress period in your life and you say, man, I can't afford to be just exhausted. Okay. Take a week. You know, if you have time to do some runs or rides, just do them easy, do them talking pace and feel good about it and give yourself a break. You're not going to suddenly detrain. And you may even find out that you just get an energy, you know, revitalization. And then when you do a hard session a week later, it just rocks.
I think you just answered the next question then. If your heart rate variability is low, but your plan advocates a hard session, is it best to do it or instead completely change it to an easy session?
Well, yeah, heart rate variability is one of the indicators. Just how do I feel is another. But I think as for age groupers, at least, if you're in doubt, if you're motivated to train and you're normally and you're in doubt about how you feel and whether you're ready for a hard session, then that doubt would be enough for me to say, all right, go easy today. Wait a day and feel good about that. Feel good that you're sensitive to your body and that you're adjusting. And then if you wait the extra 24 hours, that may be enough that the next day you have a great high intensity session, if that was the goal.
The next and final question, I think we probably answered earlier when we talked about time crunched. Rob Cunliffe asked us, why do recreational athletes who have a volume of 10 to 12 hours a week still use 80-20 or polarized training as opposed to a 60-40 breakdown? We're going over our ground with that one, aren't we, in relation to the 4 hours a week that you mentioned in that study?
Yeah, I mean, at least I'm at 10, 12 hours a week, and I can't do 4 hours of that at high intensity.
No, me neither.
I mean, I can 1 week, but then I won't be any good the next week. So in fact, one of the things you can show is that if you do two or three high intensity sessions in a row, already by that third session, your maximum heart rate will be depressed. You won't be able to, in general, we'll already start to see that maximum heart rate is lower after two or three hard sessions in a row. And we see it in Tour de France athletes, you know, by the end of the tour, the domestique group, their max heart rate may be down 15 beats. So these chronic hard stimuli, that's what happens, is the body starts shutting down the sympathetic system. The responsiveness to that sympathetic stimulation just goes down.
Stephen, it's been fantastic again. Thank you so much for being on the show. You've been very gracious with your time today. I really appreciate it, and I'm sure our listeners will too.
Well, thanks. Yeah, we tend to do some marathon sessions, but that's what we're here for, so I hope they help.
No, they will do. So, thank you on behalf of all of us, myself included. It's always a great one-to-one learning lesson for me when I have you on the show.
All right. Take care. Good training.
Thank you, Stephen. Best wishes.
Right then, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.